Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first in a series of Praxis webinars on using the best practice self-assessment tools to create systems change. My name is Denise Ang, and I'm the Praxis Community Assessment and Institutional Analysis Program Manager. And I'm joined on the call today by Maren Hansen, also from Praxis, and by Lucy Pope and Jane Sadusky, Praxis Technical Assistance Partners, and Rhonda Martinson from Equitas. You'll be hearing a little more about who they are later. I'm also joined on the call by my colleague Liz Carlson, who's going to take us through the technical aspects of today's webinar. Liz?
Thanks, Denise, and hello, everyone. I'm, as Denise said, I'm Liz Carlson. I'm the webinar coordinator here at Praxis. And so I just have a couple of quick logistical things to go over with you as far as webinars go, because there are perhaps some of us on the session today who have not been on a webinar previously. And so we're excited that you could join us. We're excited about this topic. And so I wanted to let you know that the phone lines will be muted today for the entirety of this session. We will rely instead on the chat feature to engage with each other and to hear your questions and comments at any point during the session. And so if I can direct your eye at this point, many of you have already found this chat feature, but if the rest of us could please look at the lower left-hand corner of your screen, you will see a little box that says chat. There are some people who are right now entering some, you know, little bits and pieces. And so if you would, each of us, let's just quickly chat in a quick little hello. So if you go to the white box at the very bottom of your screen, click your cursor, click a little hello, and either hit enter or the arrow key, we will see who is on the line. So let's just try out that feature quickly.
All right, as people are doing that, Liz, it does seem like there might be a couple people who cannot hear us. They are called into the conference line. Any advice for participants in that situation?
No, I'm not sure why they would not be able to hear us, the audio piece. So perhaps they, if you could direct them, Maren, by the chat to dial back in, hang up, dial back in, and use the conference code. 5253.
Yep, sure
count.
Will.
Yep, let's try sure that. Will. So, very good. Welcome. It's good to see your hellos, all of you that are attending today. And I also want to just point out that if during the session today there is anyone that would like to chat privately with any of the presenters or with me in the case that maybe there is some technical glitch happening on your end, you can go to the private tab. Within that chat box, there's a little tab at the top that says private, and you will see the list of all the presenters on the line today. Double-click on any of those presenters, and it will open a private dialogue chat box between you and that person. So that's an option for you at any point. If you lose your connection today and need to get, you know, reconnected, go back to the original join link that you connected with this session from, and you should be able to get routed right back into the session. If you are unable to do that for some reason and you need to contact the webinar service, you can dial 1-800-799-4510. That's the iLink tech support, and let them know that you're calling for a Praxis event that is under the BWJP account. So please do that. Contact me, send me a private chat if you'd like, if you have any other technical difficulties. And finally, we just want to let you know that this session is being recorded and will be available on the Institutional Analysis website page, the Audio Archive website page, next week. So look for it there. That's all I have. Back to you, Lucy.
Thank you. Welcome to today's audio conference training on best practice assessment tools. This webinar is offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Lucy Pope, and I'll be the host for today's call. Just to go over a couple things before we actually start here, the links to the materials for today's sessions were forwarded to you yesterday. They can also be found at the Praxis International website. In addition, we'll be emailing you a copy of today's slides after the call. At any point, again, you're welcome to ask questions on the chat feature. Praxis staff Denise Eng and Maren Hansen-Kramer will be available to answer those questions on the chat. Or you're invited to email any questions you have to denise@praxisinternational.org, and we'll get back to you. Today's webinar is How Do We Measure Up? Using the Best Practice Assessment Tools to Create Systems Change. You should be seeing the first slide on your screen now. The second slide. We have two presenters today. Both of them have been very familiar and working as experts on community assessments for a long time. Let me introduce you. Jane Sadusky from Madison, Wisconsin, is a writer and independent consultant on community response to violence against women. Her experience in the battered women's movement spans 30 years and includes work with shelter and advocacy programs, coordinated community response projects, and law enforcement agencies. She's a longtime Praxis technical assistance partner and has worked with many community assessment and safety audit teams over the past 12 years. Jane co-authored with Ellen Penz on a number of publications related to institutional analysis, including the Praxis Safety and Accountability Audit Toolkit. That's the foundational manual for assessment work. Jane and Rhonda worked together in the development of the best practices assessment tools that guide this series of webinars. Rhonda Martinson is in St. Paul. She's an attorney for Equitas, the prosecutor's resource on violence against women. For 14 years, she served as a managing attorney at the Battered Women's Justice Project. There, she provided national training and technical assistance on coordinating community responses, the role of prosecutors in a CCR, and evaluating prosecutorial and other criminal justice responses to violence against women. Rhonda has written extensively on conducting domestic violence safety and accountability audits of the criminal justice system, and she's written final reports for interagency teams assessing law enforcement and prosecution. In her past, Rhonda was also a domestic violence prosecutor, a 911 call taker, and a jail officer. So this is the first of a three-part webinar series on best practice assessment tools. These tools are designed for an interagency team to examine one or more of four areas of practice: 911 emergency communications, patrol response, investigations, and prosecution charging. The tools will help your community determine how you're doing, are your efforts making things better or worse, and are you strengthening safety for victims or enhancing offender accountability. Today we'll focus on selecting the team, designing a structure and timeline, and mapping your current response. So, Rhonda, will you get us started?
Thanks, Lucy. My name is Rhonda Martinson, and I'm an attorney at Equitas, which is a prosecutor's resource center on violence against women. And I'll be co-presenting this call today with Jane Sadusky. So let's find out who's with us. I'm curious who is participating and from what perspective you might be approaching a best practices assessment. And so you see before you now a little poll. And if we've missed your particular profession or perspective, please check other and chat it in. But I'm interested to see, oh, people are already filling it out. Great. Probably don't have to say anymore. If you're approaching this kind of work from a project management perspective, if you come from a perspective of victim advocacy or other sorts of victim services, if you're in a law enforcement position, a prosecutorial position, a court staff, someone that belongs in the criminal justice system, case management, other. Maren, are you monitoring our others? Any little themes there that we're seeing pop up?
Yeah, that we're, looks like we have someone who's in government administration.
Okay. Can't forget them.
NV service providers. What would NV be?
Nevada
service provider.
I know I live there.
Yeah. I was like, well, it could be a state or it could be an acronym, you know, in our work. So many acronyms. Victim services, grant management, government, admin, prevention, coalition.
Great.
And
Rhonda, I'm just going to jump in here briefly again. This is Liz. So anyone who maybe is unfamiliar with this, if you would just press these little round radio buttons, they're called, to make your selection of the discipline that you are kind of representing on this call today. We have a pretty low response rate thus far. So anyone who hasn't taken that opportunity to select one of those options, we'd appreciate it if you would.
It does. I got a note from somebody that the polar isn't working, so it looks like people are just chatting in responses.
Okay. All right.
So
victim services, project management, law enforcement, criminal justice system. Looks like we've got kind of that general theme going on.
Okay, great. That helps us answer your questions that you may chat in over the next hour. Let's move along and take a look at not only what perspective you might be approaching this work from, but now what your community may or may not have already done in this regard. So let's just step through these one by one and see how your hand-raising function works. That is at the upper left-hand corner of your screen. A little black hand with a thumb sticking out that says my status. So when I ask each of these, could those of you who are listening please give a click or not as applies to you? Has your community done any organizing work in a CCR, in a coordinated community response? Have you done anything, for example, to create a family justice center, to form a Duluth model of coordination, to form a task force, a council, a domestic violence response team? Just wait a moment and give people a chance to click. Looks like we've got about 7 or 8 people that would answer yes to that question. How about this? Anybody conducted a safety and accountability audit or a best practices assessment of any sort? Have you put together a team and looked at a part of your criminal justice system, for example, as to how it responds to domestic violence cases, how it incorporates victim safety, how it accounts for offender accountability? Got one lone little hand there, I see it. How about court watches? Anybody been involved in their community in establishing a court watch or participated in a court watch? Where you've actually gone to court and conducted court observations, maybe made a report of those observations. Looks like we've got a few of those people. Okay, very good. Last but not least, how about a fatality review team? Has anyone been involved in reviewing the death of a victim of domestic violence, or perhaps you were looking for gaps in safety in your systemic response, looking at what you might have done differently that perhaps could have prevented that death or the deaths of others in the future?
Someone chatted in that they did a fatality review, Rhonda.
Okay. And any other methods that you may have been involved in your community, either to build a CCR or to improve or otherwise evaluate your CCR? Maybe some of you have been involved in a research project, for example. I know the National Institute of Justice is interested in those kinds of projects. Or maybe you've been involved in a policy review or have a policy review board and getting a group together to look at domestic violence policy. Anything that I've said has rung a bell?
A couple people have chatted in that they have coordinating councils in judicial districts in Illinois.
Okay.
And Melissa Knight has worked with a DV court that has a multi-agency task force that meets regularly.
Okay. Very good. So quite a variety of experience here and a variety of perspectives. Again, I know that those of you that attend these sorts of trainings are used to these questions, but it is helpful in us answering questions throughout the webinar and also maybe to jog some questions that you maybe hadn't thought to ask until now. So let's keep on going. Jane?
All right. Thanks, Rhonda. Well, there's certainly a great depth and breadth of experience, as we heard or saw in our brief polls there, in paying attention to how we organize our communities to respond to this key issue of community safety. And as Lucy gave you the list of the best practice assessment tools when we opened, and you'll see them up in front of you right now, again, if you're working on the front end of the criminal legal system, that's the focus of this current set of best practice assessment tools, looking at emergency communications, police patrol, follow-up investigations, and charging decisions. And the tools are really meant to be useful for a small interdisciplinary work group and to conduct a relatively quick review of the response to domestic violence-related cases in one or more of these areas. You may decide to use one of these tools or perhaps all four of them. Our webinar series is going to address how to put together and make use of all of the methods in the tools, and we're starting today with number one, looking at some of the front-end organization as well as the mapping, which is the first big information gathering tool that we'll be talking about today. And the tools are built on many of the lessons that we've learned from safety audits, community assessments over the past 15 years or so, hasn't it, Rhonda?
Yes, and I was just going to say a couple words about that. These lessons learned that so many of us on this call have learned, and Jane and I and the folks from Praxis have been involved in these kinds of safety audits and assessments for the last 12 to 15 years, really have pointed out to us the complexity of all the systems and institutions in place and all the states and counties and municipalities in our country, all those institutions and agencies that were created to with missions of public safety, for example, public health, public quality of life, but often due to the press of caseload become very assembly line-like, very factory-like. And those of us that have been around for a while need only attend a few trainings of criminal justice practitioners or a few meetings to get that sense of how that's evolved. So I actually noted down a few of those things from recent memory, and I've got a couple here where people in the criminal justice system have said about the complexity of systems, well, I only have time to do the work, not to process it. Or another one was, is I attend these meetings to get information from experts, not to be an expert or think like an expert myself. I don't have time for that. And the last one that I, that probably says it more succinctly is, my prosecutor has a production mentality. And if you think back, perhaps jogged a little bit by what I've said, you really get that sense, I think, from people that you meet with, that you train with, and you work with in these institutions every day, that they are very complex, and as human beings, we struggle for ways to make them more efficient for ourselves. Unfortunately, that means that our systems aren't often designed very well to account for battering and domestic violence, which are patterns of behavior, not individual incidents in a person's life. And you can really see a good example of, or not just a example, but many examples of this in one of the writings on the Praxis website, which is Invisible Workings. And it's a really great piece of work and a really good training tool on the problematic features of institutions, how we have as a world or a group of human beings, again, trying to manage all these systems, we become very specialized to make ourselves more efficient, which unfortunately often fragments the services and attention that people need to get. Casey Gwynn and Gail Strack and a group of folks from that community actually did a safety audit as a planning tool for their family justice center and found out that victims were having to go to 31 different places to do what they needed to do, to meet appointments they were asked to make, to get services that they were asked to apply for in the context of kind of your typical misdemeanor violence case. You know, they had to go here for protection order, there to meet with a follow-up detective, here about a no-contact order, there to get additional services and so on. And so as a final comment before we pass the torch to Jane again, is this best practice assessment. We offer this tool and this process not as a group of assumptions about what best practices are, but really through working together on over 70 safety audits, many of them about this part of the system that we're going to be talking about today, which is 911 through law enforcement, and finding some really common threads and themes about victim safety and offender accountability.
Thanks, Rhonda. The other foundation piece, in addition to the core practices that have emerged from this collective experience with safety audits and community assessments, are these elements of effective intervention. And this is something, this identification of, you know, what goes into effective intervention in domestic violence in the criminal justice system. This work came out of the Blueprint for Safety, and again, kind of anchored in a community assessment conducted by St. Paul and Ramsey County. We're not going to go into each one of these here, but to reinforce that the workbooks, the best practice assessment tools, are a key way of looking at whether and how these elements are present at the point of intervention under review. And at the back of the whole set of tools, you'll find this overview of each one of these in much more detail. So two foundations for what the tools that you may have taken a look at already or will be looking at when you go to the website later, one being the collective experience and identification of core practices, and then the elements of effective intervention, again, kind of grounded in this collective experience. And the best practice assessment tools are, sometimes we've called them sort of community assessment light, although I don't want to diminish their usefulness in that way. But they are designed to be not as complex as a safety and accountability audit, not as complex as launching into the Blueprint for Safety, but as a way to bring together a smaller group, interdisciplinary group, complete the work over a series of 3 to 5 meetings, over a period of 1 to 6 months. One is probably stretching it. The organization of things itself would take a little more time than that, but something that is doable within roughly a 6-month period of time, conducted by a small team. It's a limited kind of information gathering and data collection in comparison to the safety audit and the community assessment approach. It doesn't involve that focus group piece. It doesn't involve an extensive amount of interviews or observation of practices. So it's grounded really very much on both laying out an understanding of the steps involved, this map of case processing that we'll be getting into in a few minutes, as well as really digging into case files and records, 911 calls, police reports, documents related to charging decisions. And our second webinar that will be coming up in a couple of months, we'll be focusing on that piece of work, that looking at case records as a tool in the best practice assessment. A couple of things to emphasize. It's not a checklist that one person takes and sits in their office and checks off. And it's not, again, that broader and deeper look that's reflected in something like a full-blown community assessment. So it's a limited scope, and may be particularly useful if there are some challenging local conditions. Maybe the 911 center and the police department are really excited and gung-ho about looking at how things are working. Prosecutors, not so much. Not to pick on prosecutors, Rhonda.
You're right.
Yeah. And it's, again, looking at a relatively narrow scope of intervention. 911, patrol response, prosecution, charging, and backing up to looking at follow-up investigations. It could also be this introductory step or a prelude to doing a new community assessment or safety audit, a kind of tune-up where a community may have used these other tools to look more deeply. And perhaps 5 or 6 years ago did a complete community assessment safety audit of everything from 911 up to prosecution. Now want to go back and just kind of check in and pull some of those calls, pull some of those case files, and take a look at things. So we thought that it would be kind of helpful to hear from everyone at this point. Rhonda, you want to launch into our chat question? And
yeah, this is a good transition point. Just as Jane has wrapped up that slide with some examples of what people might want to do with a process like this, what their interest might be, that's what we'd like to hear from you is what is your interest in doing a best practices assessment? Is it, are you just trying to learn something more about it today? Are you a bit further along in that sort of project where you have an actual focus that you could tell us about, an actual area or a particular question that you're going to look at? What is your interest today in doing best practices assessment? Could you chat it in for us?
It looks like people are maybe typing. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. Learning more about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll mention, too, we'll be covering some of the organization pieces and the mapping in this call. The subsequent webinars will deal with the other steps. And then also, if you go to the workbooks, the tools themselves on the website, there's also a comparison chart there to kind of help figure out the difference between best practice assessment, is this the best fit? Safety and accountability audit, might that be the best fit? So there's more detail there about trying to balance off what might be most useful.
There we go.
So it's looking like people are responding to the chat now saying that they're interested in learning more about it generally, but also as a possible prelude to a safety audit, which I like. It looks like another person is participating who has both rural and an arrest grant, and they are looking at an assessment process for their CCR task forces. Another person is wondering what exactly are best practices right now and how could we adopt them in a community that might be a little hesitant about that process. I wonder if she's in a rural community. We know a lot of rural communities have struggles with that. And then it looks like there's a court that's developing a DV-coordinated court, and so they're looking at how to improve systems.
Okay. My favorite one is being a praxis sponge. I like that one.
I like that one.
Well, let's go on, and while we're switching slides here, the person that wanted to know what is a best practice, I would encourage anyone that wants to brainstorm about that to give Praxis or the Better Women's Justice Project or Equitas a call. That is a discussion that we see a lot nationally about this buzzword of evidence-based practices and what that means. President Obama's administration has really started a government website on evidence-based practices, what that means. And so I understand people's desire to really clearly define best practice, and give us a call if you need to brainstorm that.
I'll just tie that back in a bit to something we've mentioned briefly earlier, in that the tools that we're working with and in using this best practice, core practice language, emphasizing that they're grounded very much both in that collective knowledge that's been built up, both in the criminal justice system reform work over the past 30 years, those 70 or so community assessments, safety audits, and then within the blueprint for safety, those elements of effective intervention. In that document, there's a whole chapter that references taking stock of the research and what we know at this point in time about effective intervention in domestic violence cases. And actually, Lucy Pope, who is on our call today as well, was steeped in all of that research material. So that foundation is there, and we'd encourage everyone to kind of take a look at that, and then we can, as Rhonda said, we're always available to help brainstorm if you're needing to have a conversation in your own community. So
okay.
Back to you, Rhonda.
Thank you. So this slide that you see in front of you kind of helps organize the rest of our conversation today. I'd like to take a few minutes just to talk about organizing and preparing. In a few moments, Jane will take us through mapping and then analyzing case processing, reporting our findings, and recommending change are the topics of subsequent webinars in this series. So let's just talk for a few minutes about organizing and preparing. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I think a lot of it is common sense. I can tell that a lot of you on this call are people with a lot of project management experience, but perhaps if you do have a question about organization or preparation, you could chat it in as I'm talking, and then we could answer that quickly before moving on to our mapping exercise. So some important things that we'll highlight in organization and preparation for an effort like this and looking at practices in your community is assigning a coordinator. How many of us go to meetings and work with people who seem to think that simply showing up at the meeting is the work? No, it's not. You need to assign someone to, as my boss says, somebody needs to make work happen. And so I'm working on a project similar to this sort of work right now where the audit coordinator has actually developed a task list or an action plan, perhaps might be a better word, where she simply notes down what people are going to do. And so if someone has said, I will look up a sample breast pocket card for police, for example, and I'll bring it to the next meeting, that person is jotted down in a little box, and that person is held accountable for that at the next meeting. So there isn't this sort of vague looking from side to side at the next meeting that I thought you were going to do that. Again, a coordinator is needed to make work happen. The other thing to highlight is selecting a team. It's really important that the team be a multidisciplinary team, including people in the world of victim advocacy, who are really your kind of local experts on what the theme of these practices usually are, which is victim safety. And it's also important that they have training in this area, that they have good multidisciplinary and systemic relationships and good system knowledge. This is not a place for someone to have an internship experience, someone that really is very inexperienced and is really at a lesser power dynamic of other people in the group to speak up or participate or debrief problems. And it's also not a place for punishment, basically. Sometimes we have people that, shall we say, a supervisor is mad at for a time being and looking for a place to put them, and this is not the place to put an employee that's needing something to do. So again, selecting a team is really important to getting the work done, and we just described some qualities of a good team and good team members. Structure and timeline is important to have credibility in the community. In other words, hopefully you're not doing this because you have nothing else to do. You're doing this because you hope to affect some change. Maybe there's some problem with victim safety or offender accountability you'd like to address. And that isn't going to be a very credible effort or recommendation to make if you've established no structure or timeline to get it done. If it just seems to be something that, well, when it gets done, it gets done. If it's 2 years from now, that's fine. It won't be very credible to the person receiving the recommendation if you've based some of your work on things that happened 3 years ago. So planning even in a simple sense, some sort of structure or timeline so that what you end up with is credible to the people you show it to is very important. And so is establishing a confidentiality agreement. Again, it doesn't have to be anything fancy, but the fact that you are noting to people, for example, that what we're talking about here today is confidential, what we're doing today should not be repeated to family members or friends. You could have something like that on paper that is signed. It is really important. I was sort of tangentially or peripherally involved in a project several years ago where that sort of understanding wasn't made clear in this particular project, and somebody felt it was okay to basically go and gossip about a couple of the findings in the community, and that got back very quickly, and it basically stopped the project. People were not willing to work on it anymore because they felt that what they were talking about as far as problems wasn't being respected. And so lastly is gathering and organizing policies and case files to review. This kind of, I guess you could visualize something that's quite a stack of paper and a desk that sounds rather overwhelming, but it could be something that's what I would call a site, S-I-T-E book, that perhaps you create a large book that stays in one place that everyone can use instead of creating 15 of those books, and thus it's not as overwhelming as it sounds. So a place that people can refer to if you want to look up and say, well, do they have a policy on that or don't they? I thought we had a probable cause determination. I thought we had a predominant aggressor policy. I thought officers were ordered to give victim information to victims who they're responding to. Those are things that you can collect in a book and keep on site to refer to. Any questions before? I know that was really fast, but again, I want to hit the highlights for a group of people that I assume is rather experienced in this area and give more time to Jane and her mapping exercise.
Well, and I'll mention too, Rhonda, that in the workbooks themselves, there are templates, there are sample ways of organizing your small team, there are sample timelines, options to consider, addressing how many files should we pull together, and a lot of detail step by step for each element in each of these tools. So we'd encourage you to also take a look there for some more detail that may fit your specific circumstances and your communities.
All right, so here is a question that's come in from Margaret Rosa. Have you heard about any legal issues concerning confidentiality agreements at CCRs? For example, members being called to court or, you know, members breaking confidentiality, how you handle that?
I have, and that's kind of a long answer because I've actually, again, been sort of tangentially or peripherally involved in three kind of local legal argument kinds of situations with this very question. They're each a little bit different, so if I could answer Margaret privately or answer anyone else that's interested, I'd be glad to do that. But basically, it's something that's defensible and is workable, but something that you should be aware of for certain defense attorneys in these kinds of cases.
And this is occurring to me, this might be something we'd put on our list for the possible future audio conference or webinar related to these confidentiality questions in the context of community assessments and best practice assessments, that sort of tool.
You know, it occurs to me, Jane and Rhonda, this might be something just to really be sure that we emphasize when we, in the next webinar, when we're talking about case record analysis, is how to handle that and the importance of it. I know that team members breaking confidentiality can create some significant problems in terms of the working relationships in the community and can have significant negative impact. And so it might be something to really emphasize in our next webinar.
Good point. And we'll tie that in definitely with that topic. We're going to move on to the first big step in the gathering information in this process, and that's what we call mapping or laying out. How does a case move through this point of the system, and what happens there. So the purpose of it is to really get an understanding of what are these steps in the official response of 911 to a domestic violence call. What are the steps? What are the steps that a patrol officer takes in that law enforcement response? It uses the expertise of the team members that are around the table. If you were looking at 911, for example, you would want to have someone from 911, the emergency communications, call taking and dispatch, a patrol officer or two, because their work is very closely linked, and a couple of advocates, because they offer and bring that perspective of hearing from the experiences of battered women in the community. So it's using that expertise, and then it's asking questions and diagramming, drawing, laying out, what does that look like? And we'll get into an exercise in doing that in a minute or so here. And what it does in this best practice context is it helps identify questions that need to be answered and provides a reference point to come back to then as you start listening to calls, reading case files, reading the policies. Always coming back and saying, well, what did we learn when we laid out how this happens? And some of the kinds of questions that need to be answered, we'll get some examples of those as we go along here, but it will lead to, do we have a policy? Thought we had a policy, but I'm not seeing one, or here's how I understand the policy, but it doesn't seem to be working that way in practice. How is information getting from 911 to the patrol to the prosecutor? Some of those kinds of questions then become anchored in the understanding that we're building through the mapping. And if you've already done something like a community assessment or a safety audit, this can be something you use to kind of go back and check in again and see, well, are we still as connected and as focused as we thought we were and have tried to be in making whatever changes came out of that earlier assessment process. Now, I'm going to suggest that we all kind of pretend that we're a virtual team here, and we're going to be looking at the steps in processing, the steps in handling, the steps in organizing a response to a 911 call. So in our virtual team, we'd have couple of folks from 911, a couple of patrol officers, a couple of advocates. And I'll suggest that you think about taking out a blank piece of paper and kind of draw your map as we go along. We're going to try to do this a bit on a slide and move through this process. So we've got a little bit of crossed fingers here on the technology end. But imagine that you are doing this in your own community. And we have Ms. Rhonda here, who's kind of a one-woman criminal justice system all in itself. Been worked in 911, been a prosecutor and a jail officer. We could explore any one of those. But what we're going to do is put Rhonda is going to be in her role of the dispatcher. Now, here are the broad steps, and I'm going to play with this handy little laser pointer that I was just thrilled to discover. In talking about mapping, we're laying out the steps in case processing. These are the broad steps, 911, patrol response, jail booking, arraignment. We could go on through those broad steps. For our exercise today, we're going to focus on the call to 911, and we're going to talk with our colleague who's on our virtual team and start out by finding more about how that works. So, Rhonda. Now,
yes, ma'am.
I've known that you worked at 911 for many years, but I don't know if I really know how that works. So what's the first thing that happens when a call comes in? What do you do first?
Well, I work in a rural area where we are also answering administrative lines for the sheriff's office. And so the first thing that I do is I look at the phone to see what line it's coming in on. I mean, if you work at a metropolitan area, there's, I'm assuming it's probably just that emergency line, but because that's going to guide my response into how I answer the phone. So I look to see what line it's coming in on, and assuming if your question is about 911 calls, the first thing I would do when I picked up that phone is ask, or I would identify myself as the 911 center and ask what the nature of their emergency is.
And is that something that's written by policy that says your first step is ask what the emergency is?
No. Again, that might be true at a larger center, but what I was how I was taught at my center was basically through a field training officer kind of situation where I sat along with a more experienced dispatcher for 2 weeks, and I was encouraged or asked to take notes of what that person said, how they answered calls, how they referred people to calls and so on, and use that as my guide for what to say.
So if you ask, what's the nature of the emergency? And I say, oh, my boyfriend just grabbed me by the neck, and he's breaking things in the house, and he's threatening to kill me. And I say all that. What do you do next?
The first thing I do is ask them where they are. And I hate to keep repeating, but again, I'm in a rural area. The north part of my county is actually very hilly and with a lot of bluffs, and sometimes we calls are dropped even from our law enforcement officers who are trying to radio us from that part of the county. Sometimes the transmission gets interrupted, and so it's very important in my county to first ask where the person is, even before their phone number, because again, I might not be able to get the rest of the phone call, so to speak, or even call them back, so I need to know where they are. The next, you know, hopefully the call continues at that point, and I would then ask them, I think, typical information that probably a lot of people hear or see a 911 call on TV, which is the phone number they're calling from, who is it that I'm talking to, who...
Well, why, I'm going to jump in. Why would you ask for the phone number? Don't you see that on the screen?
Yes, sometimes, but again, with the proliferation of cell phones and also the propensity of people in recent years with the economy to drop their landline service, sometimes that isn't reliable. In other words, a number doesn't necessarily mean that's where they're calling from. They might be using someone else's cell phone. They might be using a cell phone that's tied to another address other than what they are. So I kind of need to know what's in their hand, because just because something's showing up in the caller ID, I mean, they might be using that phone for about 2 seconds and then having to hang up and run someplace else.
What if I don't know where I am? What if it's a situation where I've called in and I've been driven somewhere or knocked out and now I'm coming to, and it's a different location? What do you do then?
I have to admit I'm not real knowledgeable on this, but this has been a recent issue and a recent subject of training about learning about the GPS qualities of cell phones. Unfortunately, just as I am not super knowledgeable, I find that that's true also of most of the public, and so you have to... It's almost that you have to know enough about the ability of a phone to do that, to step the owner of the phone through that process, because they probably don't know that in the first place. In the second instance, if they do, if they're stressed out or in a state of emergency, they probably aren't going to be thinking of that. So we do have some recent training that guides us on to what to say and ask the person that might help us utilize GPS to pinpoint that person's location.
And what would be an example of a couple of those questions? Like if a caller doesn't know where they're at and you're trying to find that out, so you want to get the number, right? A very
right.
phone number?
I would ask if they know if their phone has, if the GPS location application has been activated in that phone. I know, for example, when I got my phone, there's a little piece of paper that comes with the phone and all the equipment that tells you that and tells you how to do it. I would ask that person if they know if that's been done. If they don't, I would ask them what kind of phone they have, how old it is, to see if I could quickly look that up for them.
Okay. I'm going to step in a minute here and point out that we could pick up a number of things here and go in much more detail about what is this whole process of how you talk with someone who doesn't know where they're calling in from. But let's, again, we're a virtual team here. And I'll ask first, is there someone who's a police officer on our virtual team who has a question that they would want to ask the 911 team member about? How are things working? How does this 911 call taking or dispatching, where it goes from 911 to the patrol officer, works? So if there is anyone on in our team here who's working from that law enforcement perspective, what kind of question would you have? You can chat it in, please.
We've had a couple of people who signed in and said they were from law enforcement, so I'm wondering if anybody has a question they could ask, chat in for Rhonda.
And again, in making the link to how you would be doing this with around your own table, is you're starting to develop this picture about how, in this case, a 911 call gets handled. What are the steps? What are the processes? What are the links? And it doesn't look like we have a law enforcement question chat, but I'll throw out an example. If I were a patrol officer, I'd want to perhaps find out and ask more about when and where do you ask about weapons and clarify how that's working in the information that's coming to me. There may be questions I want to pursue about what kind of databases the 911 call taker and dispatcher are consulting. What sort of records checks are they doing at the same time? What about anyone who's on our team as an advocate? Is there a particular question that you might want to ask of a 911 call taker? Any advocates out there? And is that Denise there?
I'm here. I can ask a question.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with your advocate hat.
Yes, if I'll put my advocate hat on,
yeah.
And I'll
ask.
And
we do have one, actually, here.
Yes,
who
Christina
has,
said.
Which is, how do you gather information from someone who is in crisis? So can you say a couple things about that, Rhonda? How do you get information when someone's in crisis, they've been hurt, they're scared, they're all of the things that go into how you can communicate?
Right. One of the things that I thought of when I saw that question pop up is in trainings, of course, if you're a dispatcher, you're going to trainings about 911. You're going to be hearing lots of 911 calls from other places. And one of the things that's always struck me is the, shall we say, poor social skill tone that you sometimes hear on 911 calls that are used in training, or some of the kind of awful ones that you hear on television sometimes. And I remember when I was trained, a senior 911 call taker saying to me, adrenaline is contagious, and I've always remembered that because if my heart is pounding and I allow that to go into my voice, that is not helpful to the person I'm speaking to. If I become impatient with the person's inability to give me information, that's going to come through. And so I think the most important answer to that person's question is, learning to be a good calmer of the situation, and really thinking about this as a place to employ good people skills and calming skills, being reassuring, being quiet in my monotone Wisconsin voice like I am right now. And so that would be my first thing, as I think dispatchers are often very busy and sometimes don't realize that even that aspect of their interaction with someone has a big impact on getting information from someone that's scared or upset.
We've had a couple of more. I'm sorry, before, perhaps you want to add more to this, Jane, but I just wanted to point out there's a couple of other questions, one about safety planning with victims till law enforcement arrive, and another about a history of calls from that location.
Right, and these are exactly the kinds of questions that you would develop in your mapping. We don't have time to go into all of them, but these are really good examples that have been raised in the chat about then the areas that you want to pull out. You want to find out more about exactly what do you do when someone's crying, difficult to understand, angry. What kind of safety planning takes place between the 911 call taker and the caller? Have there been other calls from that location? Is it safe for someone to stay on the line and talk? So you begin to develop this, and Lucy has very kindly been trying to kind of follow this and lay this out a bit on our slide here. I'm going to move us to a real-life example of what this can look like if you imagine doing this on a whiteboard. This actually is related to pretrial release conditions. But it starts getting a little messy, but you can begin to pull out the steps, both the steps that are following the call, answering the call, and then we started to develop many points and the sub-steps within what goes into answering the call, what kind of code it gets, where it goes to from there, ambulance. These are very broad kind of steps that are illustrated here on this slide. And then we've provided a more detailed example of what this call receiving map, as it starts to develop, will begin to look like. And this example is also in your materials in the workbook. So from a few questions, you step deeper into all of the steps that are involved in receiving the call and begin to kind of then look at these links, where it's transferred, what happens if there's an injury, what happens with the recordings, and begin to build this picture of how things are handled and what happens.
Right, and just a few more points about that and some subsequent maps will pop up here is in the early days of doing training around the issue of mapping, we had these very complete maps, and they were almost too busy to show on a screen, where I think people were initially overwhelmed. In fact, I think someone, perhaps it was Maren, gave it looked like a maze, M-A-Z-E, because there was, it was just so full of steps. And then I think we went the other way and really had a blank piece of paper and sort of talked people through it. That was frustrating, too, because I think people need to start with at least an idea of structure. So the one that you see before you, this 911 call receiving map, is a nice, simple structure that's readable. But I just wanted to point out to you, instead of, again, simply assuming or adopting what you see here and doing nothing further, you really should be asking questions about what differences there might be in your jurisdiction that might create additional or different or extra steps. And so I'll just throw out a few of those things, and you'll probably think of others when you think about your own jurisdiction. I referred several times in my interview with Jane to being in a rural area and knowing that metropolitan areas were probably very different. And so you should be thinking about that. You know, what kind of center do you have? In my center, I receive the calls. I also dispatch them. So I would have many additional steps to my work as opposed to someone else in a dispatch center where there is a specialization between call takers and call dispatchers. Many centers those are two separate positions which would be stepped out differently. Are you in a small jurisdiction or a large jurisdiction, kind of the same as rural? So again, I could think of many other kinds of questions here, but just as we've been using our conversation with you and the interview between Jane and I to sort of flesh out what those differences might be, you shouldn't be doing a map in a vacuum. It shouldn't be one person sitting at a table by him or herself sort of sketching this stuff out. You really need to be having a discussion and saying, oh, yeah, this person does that. Oh, that's right. We've got a record system over here. When Rhonda gets a call, she asks Jane to look that up for her. Those are the kinds of things that you want to have at your sort of mental fingertips to plug in when you're doing a map.
You'll be spending a couple hours in developing it so that you have that opportunity to develop much more detail and begin to answer some of those questions in that process. Is it safe for a caller to stay on the line? What does it mean to secure the scene? Does an arresting officer flag a 911 call for the prosecutor? You start pulling all those threads, and then as Rhonda has pulled up here, you can begin to develop then what it looks like from 911 through the patrol response.
Right. And so, again, Jane was good at transitioning us. She just stated a few really good questions you'd want to ask yourself or your group as you're constructing this sort of map from 911 to arrest. You know, what is going on between the 911 center and the officer at this point? A couple other things I can think of is, again, that records responsibility question. Whose role is it to look at, I don't know, if there's an existing protection order, for example. I've been in jurisdictions where it's a 911 operator's responsibility. I've been in others where it's the patrol officer's responsibility to go to a particular officer database from his or her car and look that up himself. And I've been in other jurisdictions where because of the kind of 24 hours a day aspect of the jail, it's actually jail staff that is the repository of those kinds of records. So, again, don't make assumptions. Ask and talk that stuff through, and you might be surprised at what you find. And one more, and then we'll kind of flip it back to Jane, is moving forward again in the process as to the officer's decision-making process. Here you see a map here of what an officer does as far as determining whether or not probable cause to arrest does or doesn't exist, and you can kind of read through that as I'm talking. Some other things that you might want to ask is, do you have policy that requires you to make determinations along with your probable cause determination as to predominant aggressor, self-defense, and other sort of criteria steps that need to be stepped through here? Whose job is it to sign off on probable cause? As a lawyer, I know that in the 1990s, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case, Riverside, California, where there is a requirement of judicial involvement in probable cause determination. So many officers now have a policy after making an arrest or issuing a warrant of having a judge or some other court official sign off on it. Officers sometimes have the responsibility to travel to a judge's house, email to a courthouse, or something of that sort. So that is something you'd want to be thinking about here also. And again, many other examples and potential steps I could think of, but kind of want to give you the idea that you need to be asking questions and sitting down with your multidisciplinary group, which hopefully will include a police officer that you can use as your expert while you're doing these maps.
Thanks, Rhonda. To recap this piece of the best practice process in looking at how cases move through the mapping, part of it is to remember to really anchor it in what's happening for real people. So what are the experiences of victims who are calling 911? What kind of understanding of that experience and response to people in crisis, response to trauma, how questions are asked, the kind of information that gets asked, where the case goes from there, how advocacy intersects. So if you imagine making your map of looking at, say, 911 through prosecution charging, one of the other pieces will be to develop where and how and in what ways is there a connection made with advocacy and information about what's happening and what's going on. I'm thinking, I know someone had chatted in at the beginning, in their community, the felony court had been disbanded. And laying out, for example, step by step by step, what happens now with a felony case? Where does information come from? Where are decisions made? Where's the connection with advocacy? This kind of first step of laying that out might be a useful strategy. So in this, to recap, we're always coming back to what are the steps, what's happening at this point, who's intervening, where, when, in what ways, what's the sequence of actions, what comes first, what comes next, where does it go from here, and then what are the key themes and questions that we need to address. So, for example, having done this with a number of communities around 911 response, the kinds of themes and key questions that have come up in some jurisdictions have been that response to trauma and crisis and how questions are asked and information is developed, how well are 911 call takers prepared to calm and develop the essential information they need. One community, they were missing a lot of the weapons information that officers were assuming they were getting. So using this first step in the best practice assessment to begin to identify the key themes and questions that you'll then pick up and explore further in looking at the case documents, the calls and the records and the policy, and bringing it all together to make sense of it.
Thank you, Jane.
So, how to proceed in your own community? We're coming up towards the end of our call, which has really blazed by, but a couple of opportunities here if anyone has a specific question and could maybe tell us about what you plan to do between now and our May webinar. Have you started one of these best practice assessments? Are you thinking you might start one? The kinds of questions that you'd be asking in a community end would be, is this tool a best fit for us? You can pull up the workbooks on the website, and there's a lot of information there. We're available to answer any and all questions to help clarify. Oh, here's a little bouncing ball again. About this particular tool, the best practice assessment, and how that might work for your community. Deciding what to look at. Maybe you've thinking, yeah, this might be a good idea, but how do we know? Do we look at 911 only? Do we look at the patrol response? Do we try to look at everything these four tools cover, from 911 to prosecution charging? Looking at recruiting a team, clarifying those questions of confidentiality, and diving in. So anyone out there who's decided to take the plunge, so to speak?
I want to thank you, Jane, for all of that. And the next webinar will be...
I'm going to pick up on one of our chat questions here just before I turn it back to you, Lucy. I apologize for that. Christine is noting that they've tried out an initial mapping project, and trying to pick which processor system to focus on is hard. And there are many possibilities when you think of all of the points of intervention in this system. The tools provide some guidance in thinking about starting perhaps with 911 and patrol or aspects of prosecution. Part of that's going to be related to the interest and investment and where the door is open to exploring that. And that's a common technical assistance kind of question that we're help communities problem solve through is where to begin. And I'm going to go back to you, Lucy, to pick up on what some of those technical assistance activities.
Well, I was just going to let you know that the next webinar is going to be on May 9th, and we'll be going into analyzing case files. But around the 1st of, did I say Mark? May 9th. Around the 1st of May, we're going to be contacting the participants to check in, see how you're doing, find out if you have any questions. So the next webinar will start the first 15 minutes with answering your questions. So please do keep in touch, and as you're moving through and want some information, let the Praxis team know. But there are a lot of educational opportunities right now at Praxis. Denise, can you give us a summary of those?
I absolutely can. Thank you, Lucy. Praxis has a number of other activities and training opportunities coming up over the next few months related to this whole notion of assessing your community response. As Lucy has just said, our next webinar in this series is going to be on May 9th. We also have monthly networking and discussion calls for people who are involved in community assessments, and the next one of those calls is scheduled for Wednesday, March 28th from 2 to 3:15 p.m. All of these calls are from 2 to 3:15 on the fourth Wednesday of each month. This is more of an informal opportunity for people to call in and have a conversation about whatever it is that they're dealing with in their community related to their assessment. We usually have a specific topic, although people can call in about other issues. Our next topic is going to be on planning case review and text analysis. So if you're interested in doing that, please call into that audio conference on Wednesday, March 28th at 2 p.m. Central. We also have a series of audio conference trainings in addition to the networking calls. And the next audio conference training call is scheduled for April 26th, and that one is on accounting for the complexities of life and social standing. And then finally, as I said again, the next webinar is going to be on May 9th. So you are all very welcome to participate in any of those calls. The call-in information will be the same as the audio call-in information here, and you can also watch for them in your email.
Thanks, Denise. So our time is up, and thank you. We've had a very full presentation. We really do encourage you to continue to ask questions and contact us with the numbers that you see on the screen. As you leave the webinar, you'll be automatically forwarded to an evaluation form. We do take your evaluation seriously and want to know about your experiences with this session. Thank you. Good luck with your assessment teams, and we hope to see you on May 9th in a couple of months. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.